passion for God and compassion for our neighbor, reaching our region and beyond with the life-changing message of Jesus Christ. This is Crosswinds Church. And now, here's Pastor Kurt Truxas.
We are working our way through the book of Ephesians. And so far in the book of Ephesians, we have learned how incredibly blessed we are, that we are loved by God and that Jesus Christ has died for us, and that we are literally the most blessed beings in all of creation. The second half of the book of Ephesians has talked to us about how we live because of who we are. And we are right at the end of the book, and we're learning about how we live and how this comes out in everyday relationships. We've been looking at marriage and how a Christian lives differently, how a husband loves his wife, and how a wife submits and supports her husband's leadership. And that's based on the parallel between the relationship between Christ and the church. We also looked last week at the relationships in the home and how Jesus Christ changes the way children relate to their parents and the way parents lead over their children. This morning, we're coming into a third set of relationships, and those are work relationships and how an employee works for his employer, and how an employer leads over his employee. This idea of how work relationships work and how a Christian works is a really big topic. In future weeks, I'll probably come back and maybe even do an entire series on this. But this morning, we're just going to dive into it a little bit. There's an awful lot for us to cover. So I'd ask you to get your outlines out. Open your Bibles, if you have one, to Ephesians chapter 6, verse 5, and we'll begin there. The question we're looking at this morning is this. How does Jesus change the way I work? How does he change the way I work? We'll begin by reading Ephesians 6, verse 5. And if you're using the ESV Bible, which is the standard Bible we use here at Crosswinds, it says, "Bondservants, obey your earthly masters with fear and trembling, with a sincere heart, as you would Christ." And the first question that comes to mind for us is, bondservants. What's a bondservant? That's not something we use as a term much today. And so many of us will go ahead and look at what other translations will say about this verse. And if you go to the NIV, it says this, "Slaves, obey your earthly masters with respect and fear and with sincerity of heart, just as you would obey Christ." So this is talking about slaves. Now, slavery, though, it doesn't have a really good reputation. In fact, in our country, it was one of the great heinous evils that has been committed by our nation. We were pro-slavery for a long period of time, and slavery is just a nasty thing. And then you start to wonder, why does the Bible not say much against it? Why does the Bible not come out just right out and condemn slavery as a great evil in the world? In fact, the Bible, at some points, just seems to ignore it. And here in this verse, it even tells slaves to obey their masters. What are we to think about this? Before we jump into the rest of the text, I think we need to answer this question. What about slavery? Slavery in the Bible. And to answer that question, I'd like to spend a few minutes covering what is slavery in America and then slavery in the ancient world. When we compare those two, that'll help you understand why the Bible doesn't come right out and condemn slavery as a heinous evil. So let's begin. What does the Bible teach about slavery? And the first thing we're going to do is look at slavery in America. Now, slavery as we know it from our history classes is a heinous evil. It involved people sailing ships over to the continent of Africa. It involved guns. It involved tearing people out of their beds in the middle of the night. It involved tearing apart a husband and wife never to see each other again, tearing children away from their parents, whippings and beatings. It involved stuffing human beings into the cargo holds of ships in subhuman, even sub-animalist conditions, and sailing them across to the other side of the world to be beaten and to be whipped and to be sold. Slavery in America was often a lifelong commitment. slavery in America was primarily based on race and nothing else. Slavery in America was evil. It was a dark and terrible crime. In fact, the scriptures do condemn the kind of slavery that we are very familiar with in America. It says in 1 Timothy chapter 1, verse 10, it says, "For the sexually immoral, for those who are practicing homosexuality, for slave traders and liars and perjurers and whatever else is contrary to sound doctrine." In other words, slave traders is among the list of some of the great heinous sins of mankind. But what was slavery like in the ancient world? Was it about slave traders or was it something different? Let me explain. In some ways, slavery in the ancient world was very similar to slavery in America. Slaves could be beaten. They could be mistreated. Slaves didn't have rights. In fact, there are some stories of slavery in the ancient world that come down to us that show sort of the real dark evils of it. There was a man named Augustus, and he had a slave that by accident killed his pet quail. And in response to it, he crucified the slave. And all of us would say very clearly that was wrong. There was a man named Pollio in the ancient world. And one of his slaves, a young boy, dropped a crystal goblet. And as punishment, he tried to throw him into a pit of sea lamprey, which would be a terrible and vicious death. Thankfully, the boy escaped, and the judgment that Pollio planned for him was never carried out. But that's just to tell you, there were some real evils in slavery in the ancient world. But for the most part, by the time of Christ, slavery was much more of a humane institution. Now, let me just point out some of the points here in your outline just to explain what slavery was like. First, a third of the population in major cities of the ancient world were slaves. It was very common. Slavery in the ancient world was not necessarily racial. You could have slaves of all different races, even slaves of your own race that were in the ancient world. Slaves, incidentally, also owned other slaves. And that's sort of strange, but that's what they did. If you were a slave that was somewhat wealthy and you needed somebody to help you, you could buy somebody and use them to help you. Also, for slavery in the ancient world, most slaves were free by the age of 30. That means that slavery was not a lifelong commitment in the ancient world. In fact, if you were able to save your resources and not go out and spend your money on beer and cigarettes and a cell phone, you could actually buy yourself out of slavery early in the ancient world. And when you did get your freedom, one of the practices that took place at the time of Christ was that your owner typically gave you some money and resources so when you left, you could be successful in society and a productive part of community life. So slavery wasn't all bad. In addition, as I mentioned here, slaves could buy their freedom if they saved their money. And if you were an unwanted child, you may actually become a slave. Well, we covered this a little bit last week, that unwanted children in the ancient world were typically disposed of through the practice of infanticide. When a child was born into the house, it was brought before a father. And if a father picked the child up, the child was welcomed into the family. And if the father stood up and walked away, the child was taken away and disposed, usually put into a field to be eaten by wild animals. But if the wild animals didn't pick up that newborn baby, sometimes they were picked up by perverts of the worst kind. But other times, lower class Roman citizens who could not afford slaves would see a child that had been abandoned, and they would take that child and they would bring it into their home and they would raise it. And as that child grew, that child was told that they were to function as that lower class Roman citizen's slave. Their slavery was sort of like in exchange for their life and for them being saved by that Roman citizen. Now, typically, that wasn't the way things were practiced for Christians. Christians, when they picked up children that were unwanted in the fields, they usually adopted them into their own family and gave them the full rights of citizenship, just like Jesus Christ has adopted us into his family and given us the full rights of becoming brothers and sisters of Jesus Christ. And that's why Christians practice things differently. But I tell you this so you know how slavery was practiced in the ancient world. Slavery was also a way that people got out of debt. In the ancient world, when you went into debt, you couldn't just file Chapter 11. You didn't get a chance to get out of your financial obligations. You didn't get typically put into jail. What you did is you were enslaved to your creditor, and you worked as a slave for your creditor until you paid off the debt that you owed him. Which in some ways I think is probably not that bad of an idea. Because when somebody defaults on a loan, the person who they borrowed the money to is left holding the bag. And here in the ancient world, the people who loaned out money were typically not left holding the bag. They had a way of recouping some of that. Slavery was also a way out of poverty. It was a way out of poverty. Because in the ancient world, when you couldn't make ends meet, the government didn't send you a welfare check. So you could sit in your living room on a couch watching ESPN while you're drinking beer and smoking cigarettes. You were literally on the street if you didn't have the financial means to pay for yourself. And so people who are running on the edge of poverty, what they would typically do is they'd approach a wealthy Roman citizen and they'd say, "Can I sell myself into slavery in your household?" And the Roman citizen many times would accept. And that guaranteed that poor person a much better financial life. Plus, they took on the responsibility of working and trying to give back to the person they were now enslaved to. And once again, they didn't have to be a slave for the rest of their life. They could be freed after a few years when they were in better financial circumstances. So I say all this so you know that slavery in the ancient world was very different from what the slavery that we are accustomed to when we think about slavery in America. Slavery in the ancient world was sort of a form of work. It was a form of employer-employee type relationships. Now, while the Bible doesn't come right out and condemn slavery because it's sort of a form of employment, the Bible does, I have to tell you, knock down the pillars that slavery is built upon. Let me show you what I mean. First of all, in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verse 21, Paul encourages slaves to gain their freedom. He doesn't say if you're a slave, try and stay a slave. He says try and gain your freedom if it can be afforded to you. Next thing the Bible says, the Bible tells us to love our neighbor, not to try to own our neighbor. And the idea of tearing a husband and wife apart in the middle of the night and whipping them and beating them and dragging them off into slavery is not really qualifying for, like, loving your neighbor. So the Bible undermines that. The Bible also tells us to treat others like we would like to be treated. Is there anybody here who would like to be treated as a slave? Absolutely not. Of course not. So the Bible undermines that pillar. The Bible also tells us that we are to be imitators of Jesus Christ, and Christ did not own slaves, did he? He lived in a time when slavery was very common, and it was the acceptable means of practice, the way people lived every day. But Jesus didn't own slaves. In fact, Jesus acted like a slave. He acted like a servant. John chapter 13 tells us that Jesus got up from the table and he washed the feet of his disciples. He took on the position of the lowest slave. If that's the way Jesus lived, That's the way we should live. In addition, the entire book of Philemon is about treating a Christian slave like a brother. The background of the book is that Philemon had run away from his master, and Philemon was, I believe, in Rome, and Philemon becomes a Christian. Paul encourages him to go back to his boss, his employer, his master, and he sends Philemon this letter to Philemon's boss, who's also a Christian. He says, don't take Philemon back and treat him as a slave, and don't beat him, don't punish him, treat him like a brother, because he is your brother in Jesus Christ. So slavery in the ancient world, it was definitely undermined, and slavery in general was undermined by the Bible and the way it tells us to treat others. But the Bible doesn't come right out and totally condemn it, because really it's a form of employer and employee relationships. And if Paul was writing this letter today, he would write using the terms of employee and an employer, because the real issues of what's evil is not the institution of slavery. The real issues of what is evil is the human heart. And the only way to change that is by coming to Jesus Christ, who gives us a new heart and a new mind and a new love for pleasing him. Now, for the rest of the message this morning, I'd like to dive into the idea of employer and employee relationships. And we're going to begin by looking at what should be different about a Christian employee. That's the same verse we're looking at. Bondservants or employees, obey your earthly masters with fear and trembling, with a sincere heart as you would obey Christ. And here's the first point. Work for my boss like I am working for Christ. Work for my boss like I am working for Christ. This is sort of the umbrella that everything is going to be built under when it comes to employee relating to their employer. You work for your employer like you are working for Jesus himself. That means you give your employer a great amount of respect. You have incredible amounts of integrity. You work extremely hard and do your absolute best in everything you do for your employer, because you're not really working for your employer. You have to constantly be thinking of the fact, I'm working for Jesus Christ himself, and I want him to be pleased with my work much more than my employer. What this means is that when you're on the job, while everyone else is surfing the internet just to kill some time, you're actually trying to be productive. What this means is that while others are taking long and lengthy coffee breaks, you're hopping right back into the work environment and getting a job done. While others are gossiping and backbiting, you're refusing to take part of that, because you're here to work and to serve your employer and to serve Jesus, not to gossip. And what Paul is saying here, he says, as Christians, the idea is that we should be the absolute best employees possible. And that employers should be saying, I want to do anything to get a Christian employee, because they work so hard and they work so well. They're the best ones out there. This is part of our witness to the world, that we serve and work like we're working for Jesus. Now, when I was getting out of college, I worked for an intern for IBM. And when I was working for IBM, I had an office I shared with this guy who was around 50 years old. And I remember him because every day he wore his blue leisure suit, really sort of one of those classics. And he would always want to talk to me, always want to ask me about how my weekend was and how his weekend was. And he would tell me what he's doing on the next weekend. And then he said, oh, wait a minute, it's time for a smoke break. And off he would go into his smoke break. Come back at the appointed time and get right back to work. But then he'd stop and start asking me questions again, all kinds of socializing. And then, oh, by the way, I got to go. It's time for another smoke break. Back and forth. And I look back upon him and I said to myself, you know, I don't think he really did that much work. Took a lot of smoke breaks, had a lot of talk, but he had seniority, so no one was going to fire him. But while he had seniority, he wasn't really known for his productivity. Now, that's not the kind of life that or kind of employee that we're to be as Christians. We're to be known for our productivity. I want you to think for a moment with me. If you're an employer, think on your employees. If you are an employee, I want you to think of the other employees that you work with. When you think of their name, what comes to mind? People who are social, people who are lazy, or people who are productive, who work hard, who sacrifice deeply and try and do their absolute best for their employer. The idea is that as Christians, we should be known for doing our absolute best. And that should be what people remember when they think about our name. So the first thing that we learn is this. Work for my boss like I'm working for Christ. The next thing we learn is that treat my boss with respect. Treat my boss with respect. It comes right from here where it says, obey your earthly masters with respect and fear. Now, the fear word here, what does that mean? That we should be cowering in fear with our boss? Actually, it doesn't. The fear word here means that we should treat our boss with reverence. Our boss is not our peer. Our boss is our boss. He is the one who writes the paycheck for our livelihood. He is the one that holds a lot of control over our life, and we should give him great respect and great reverence. And when our boss asks us to do something, we should very quickly put aside what we are doing and do what our boss asked us to do. In other words, when our boss asks us to do something, we don't continue our projects and get our boss's project started at 4 o'clock on Friday before we get home, because that's sort of disrespect. What you do is you put your boss's project first. As soon as he asks you to do it, you get that done. Then you go back to your projects. And so the boss automatically says, you know, that's what I love about these Christian employees. They're not thinking about themselves first. They're thinking about what they can do to honor me first. That's the kind of employee I want. So we treat our boss with respect. Now, I have a question for you. That sounds easy, but what if your boss is a nutcase? And we all have those bosses we've worked for, bosses that are unreasonable. They make you work long hours. They make you work hard hours. They tell you you can be gone at 5, and 5 minutes before 5, they come in and say, I need you to stay an extra 2. You go home and you're stressed. You go home and you're irritated, and the boss doesn't treat you nice. They don't treat you kindly. They're just irritable. And how do you treat those kind of bosses? Do you just mark the clock and try and get out of there? Try and fly low and be under the radar? What do you think? How does a Christian respond to that kind of leadership by their boss? The scripture has some words for those things. It says, servants, be subject to your masters with all respect, not only to the good and gentle, but also to the unjust. For this is a gracious thing. When mindful of God, one endures sorrow while suffering. Remember, even though our boss is maybe an unjust employer, we're still working like we're working for Christ, not for him. Everything falls under that umbrella. And even though we may be frustrated, we still serve for him. Now, the nice part is that in our culture, we can always resign. We could always move on. And in the ancient culture, if you were a slave working for a master, you couldn't resign. You had to endure it. Let me give you an example for me that as I was reading this, I thought about it. Some of you know that I worked for IBM. I mentioned that. And when I worked for IBM, I was one of 4 interns that were hired actually before we got out of college to work for IBM. I was a programmer. That was my undergraduate. I was hired to program SAS code. And there were 3 other interns that were hired to program AS code. AS is a a language that IBM was writing. It was a new language at the time. It was designed to query their databases, and we worked in a parts warehouse. And I was hired to learn to write SAS code, which was actually a very robust and strong language and what the IBM had used for quite some time. But they were trying to shift away from that code and the paying the royalties and rights for using it. And so they had these new programmers with a new language, and they had me. The problem was that a lot of the programs that needed to be written couldn't be written in the new code. It wasn't that strong of a language yet. And the amount of work that I was doing as a programmer was really piling up high, while my peers were cooling their heels on the desk. Now, at first, I didn't mind it, because that meant a lot of extra overtime, and they were paying quite well. But after a while, I began to get to the point where I started to feel burned out, started to feel used. And then things went up a notch in the fall. What happened is that IBM was deciding to consolidate their three national parts warehouses for all their computers into one. And they're going to consolidate it into the one that I worked at in Pennsylvania. And what they asked every department to do was to find one person who would then go in and work at night helping to stock all these computer parts into this massive warehouse. Now, you can see how this happened. Most of the guys there were smokers, overweight, and had families. Here was the intern who was programming in SAS code, the code that we're trying to get rid of, the code we're trying to get people off of using. Not only that, but he's single. He's young. He's strong. He's a wrestler. Let's use him to stock the part warehouse at night. So I worked from midnight to 6 a.m., stocking a parts warehouse. We ended up going to some classes during the day. Ended up stopping in the office and programming some SAS code during the day. And oh, did I happen to mention that I was also still in cross country while in college with morning and evening practices? And that went on for a few weeks until I literally collapsed. I went home one night, sat in a chair, and I slept for almost 2 days straight. I don't even have memory of it, all the details in that time of my life, because I was so exhausted. And the boss, I was so frustrated, because I felt the boss was asking me to do so much more than should reasonably be demanded between working day and working night. And now I realize that I probably should have acted a lot better at the time. I should have realized that God had me in that stressful situation so I could show how a Christian employee is different when they're working for a boss that's a nutcase. And that a Christian employee is honorable to Jesus Christ even when you're in a tough situation. It's one of the things I learned from that. Maybe that'll be an encouragement for you. The next thing we learn about how a Christian employee is different is that a Christian employee has a good attitude at work. In fact, it says here in the text that we are to have sincerity of heart. Sincerity means purity of heart. It means to have a good attitude. In other words, we look at it as a privilege to work as Christians, not an obligation, not something we're trying to get out of, but it's an honor to work. In fact, if you think back on this, that Adam and Eve were created, and they were created to work the garden, and that as part of the creation order, we are to be workers, each one of us. That's part of the way we worship and bring glory to God through our work. And there should be great joy in our work. But even if there isn't great joy in our work, it's the way we honor God. And our attitude at work should reflect that it's a privilege to work. I think if you were to take two options, hard work or not having work, I think it's much harder to not have work than to work hard. It really is. So we want to be very thankful for the privilege of serving others, even when it's difficult. How about this? Work hard, even if everyone else is taking their time. That's one of the ways as Christians that we try and reflect the glory of God and we please Christ through our work. This is especially true, I noticed, when people end up working an hourly wage and when they work a minimum wage. They say, well, why work hard? I mean, why try to stress myself? Because I'm not getting paid much, and the longer it takes, the more money I'll make. And they subtly use their employer. That's not the way a Christian works. We work hard because who are we working for? Not our boss. Ultimately, we're working for Jesus. So we do our absolute best, even if it is a minimum wage job. When I was in high school, one of the things I had a chance to do was work for AT&T Technologies with computers. The way it worked out is I went and applied at a temp agency, and because I knew some really what are now old languages, I knew CPM 80 and an old word processing program called WordStar that they used in business, I ended up getting a job for my week-long summer break at AT&T Technologies. What they asked me to do was to simply type in a stack of paper. And they said it can take all week. We don't mind. Just go ahead and just get that done. Well, I just started typing, and I kept typing and didn't feel the need to take breaks a lot, didn't feel the need to go slow, and I was done in a day and a half. And I remember talking to my new employer. They said, well, this is fast. This is much faster than we expected. I said, well, I guess I'll go home for the rest of the week and nothing to do. And went home and didn't make any extra money. And some of my friends thought I was foolish for not stretching the job out. But I have to tell you what happened. 2 weeks later, I got a call back from that very same boss. And he said, you know, we've been talking. We'd like you to come in after school. After school, you can work until about 6, 6:30, go home for dinner. We'd like to pay you to work every day. And it turned into a long-term job. And I asked, well, why did you do that? And he said, it's because you worked hard. You didn't stretch it out like almost everybody else has ever done. So you do what's right and trust God with the results. You work hard at work, even if it's a minimum wage hourly job, and let God take care of you. Another thing to look is right here, work hard even when the boss isn't looking. Comes right out of Ephesians chapter 6, verse 6. Not by way of eye service as people pleasers, but as bondservants of Christ, doing the will of God from the heart. In other words, don't be an employee who just works when people are looking. Don't be an employee who just works so people think well of you. You work when you work. One of the things that I really enjoyed was when the last 3 years, my oldest son, David, has worked concrete. And he worked concrete, and he'd come home at the end of the day, and he would tell me all about work and how employees work. And he found it fascinating, and he was learning about life and growing. And one of the things he said to me, he said, Dad, do you know what happens when the boss is there? Boy, do they work hard. But as soon as the boss leaves, they start leaning on the blunt edge of the shovel, and everything slows down. And I remember thinking about this verse. You know, what kind of employee are you? An employee that just works for eye service? An employee that just works when the boss is looking? An employee that needs to be supervised all the time? That's not the way that it should be for a Christian employee. A Christian employee should not need to be supervised all the time. One of the things we have here, let me give you an example of what it looks like to be a eye service employee. That is, don't do the minimum work a job requires. Do a job right. You know what that looks like? To do the minimum work a job requires versus doing it right? This is if you're a kid and your mom asks you to clean your room. What is the minimum work that's required? To push everything under your bed. Correct? But what does mom really want you to do? To actually fold your clothes. to actually clean your room. But if you're just pushing everything under your bed, that's not being what I would call a Christian employee. You're doing the minimum work the job requires. I'll give you another example of what an iService employee looks like. Don't bill for unproductive hours. Don't bill for unproductive hours. I learned this from my wife's father. My wife grew up in a rather poor home. Her father was a laborer and just did some simple construction work. And they didn't have much money at all growing up. And one of the things that struck me was when her father was working and he would turn in the bills to be paid, he wouldn't have straight hours. He'd have gaps in there. And I asked him, why do you do that? He said, well, I was working and getting my job done, but somebody came in and wanted to talk to me. He said, I wasn't working though in those times. So when somebody was talking to me and it was unproductive, I am not billing for those hours because that wouldn't be right. And I thought, wow. Here is a guy who needs the money more than anybody else. But in the eyes of God, he says, I don't want a bill for unproductive time. I think that's good because he's not trying to just be an eye pleaser. He's trying to be an honest employee. One of the things that I've seen that really sort of frustrates me is pastors. Because pastors, like myself, they tend to work very independently. That's just the nature of the job. And you can have a pastor that works really hard and gets a lot done, or you can have a pastor that's sort of, well, let's just say it straight up, lazy. There's a number of pastors I know that try to win golf balls to Christ during the week because they try and take the pace sort of easy. They don't want to stress themselves and work hard. When I was first a youth pastor, my first full-time youth pastorate job, there was a youth pastor who also took a job as a youth pastor in a church down the road from me at the same time. We were the same age, and I would meet with him occasionally, get a chance to know him. And we started in the summer, and we were both busy with youth activities. And then when the fall came around and the kids went to school, I remember meeting with him one day, and he just confided in me. He said, Kurt, you know, now that the kids are in school all day, what do you do as a youth pastor? I looked at him. I said, well, what do you mean? What do you do? He says, well, I don't really know what to do, so I just play video games in my office. What? They are paying you, and you're just playing video games? Like, if you know the Bible that well, you have it completely memorized backwards and forwards and all of your lesson plans done for the next year, then maybe you can play video games on church time. Otherwise, you should be memorizing the entire book. They're paying you for it. And it's the idea was he was sort of like trying to use the church that way. He wasn't being productive. He was being lazy. And by the way, he didn't last for more than a year. And I think that's why. Let me give you another example. If my boss is a Christian, don't take advantage of his grace. My boss is a Christian, don't take advantage of his grace. And I've seen this a number of times as I've worked in the church and outside of the church with Christians. People are like, well, my boss is a Christian. They'll always forgive me. I don't have to always work that hard. I can come in late. I can leave early. We're all so gracious and kind for Jesus. Is that the way a Christian employee works? Let me tell you what the scriptures say here out of 1 Timothy chapter 6. It says, those who have believing masters must not be disrespectful on the grounds that they are brothers. Rather, they must serve all the better, since those who benefit from their good service are believers and beloved. In other words, if your boss is a Christian, you shouldn't count on extra grace. Your boss should count on extra work. That's what the scriptures tell us. Not trying to take advantage of grace and being an eye pleaser and a lip service. In fact, look what the scriptures say about how Christian employees should work in Titus chapter 2, 9 through 10. Bondservants, which we know are employees, are to be submissive to their own masters in everything. They are to be well-pleasing, not argumentative, not pilfering, not showing all good faith, or rather, but showing all good faith, so that, and notice this, that they may adorn the doctrine of God our Savior. In other words, the way we work should make Jesus Christ famous. I want more people like you. I want more people that are Christian employees. You're making him famous. Tell me how Jesus changed your life. That's how a Christian employee works. Well, the last piece we want to cover on Christian employees is this. Remember that Jesus will reward me, even if my boss doesn't. Verses 7 and 8 of Ephesians chapter 6 says, rendering service with a good will, as to the Lord and not to man, knowing that whatever good anyone does, this he will receive back from the Lord, whether he is a bondservant or is free. Not many of us know too much about the doctrine of eternal rewards. The Bible is clear that we are saved completely by grace through faith. It is a gift from God that we cannot earn, that we can only receive. But while we're completely saved as a gift by grace from Jesus Christ, the Bible does say that how we live once we are a Christian matters. It matters deeply, because when we go to heaven, we will be rewarded based on how we lived. Now, the only way to get to heaven is a gift of grace from God, but in heaven, we are rewarded for how we served and how we lived in all of life, even as an employee. Look what it says in 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 10. For we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, so that each one may receive what is due for what he has done in the body, whether good or evil. Now, where does this come from? The Bible tells us that this idea of getting rewards, Paul is picking up something that comes from the Isthmian Games. The Isthmian Games are the precursor of the Olympic Games. And what would happen is you'd compete in the Isthmian Games, and as you competed, there was a judge who sat at the end, and he rewarded you based on how you competed. Some he gave gold, some he gave silver, and some he gave bronze. And the idea is that one day, when we all stand before Jesus Christ as Christians, we will be rewarded by him based on how we competed in this life. And there'll be some people who had a position of power and wealth who will not be richly rewarded. There'll be some who had a position of just humility and service, the janitor, so to speak, who will be richly rewarded, because the rewards are not based on they're not based on what we had. They're based on what we did with what we had, how we served with what God has given us. So, we work and we serve really strong. We serve really hard because we're working for Jesus. We literally are working for Jesus. Because even if our employer doesn't reward us all he should, Jesus, when we stand before him, will reward us justly and fairly. Now, I have just a few more minutes. I want to cover the other side of the equation. How do I honor Christ as an employer? Let's pick up in verse 9. Masters, do the same to them, and stop your threatening, knowing that he who is both their master and yours is in heaven, and that there is no partiality with him. If you're an employer, how should you treat your employees? You treat them like you would like to be treated, with respect. Now, then he goes into this area of motivations, and he says, don't motivate with threats, or stop your threatening. How do you motivate your employees? That's one of the great mysteries. How can we motivate our employees? Don't use threatening. My former neighbor, he was at this point a plant manager for a large manufacturing plant in our area. And we were talking over the fence one day, and he shared with me what happened on his first day of work. He was being shown around the plant by a floor manager, and he was the plant manager. And he's being shown around, and they come up on a guy who was working on a rim. And this guy who was working on the rim was doing something that wasn't quite right. And so the floor manager came up to him in front of the new plant manager and just started berating him, started yelling at him, telling him how crummy he was at work, and just tearing into him. And after he was done tearing into this employee, he walked back up to the new plant manager and he said, "Sometimes that's what you need to do, these guys, just to keep them in line." And you know what my neighbor, the plant manager, did? "You're fired." On the spot. First day of work. He fired him. And here's why he fired the floor manager. He says, "You stop your threatening." That's not how we motivate employees. We love them. And we try and serve them. We think about how Jesus motivated employees, how Jesus motivated disciples. That's how we do it, not by fear. The other thing he says is this: don't show favoritism. That with Jesus there is no partiality, that God shows no partiality. And that the idea is that when you are an employer, don't show favoritism to certain employees. Try and keep it fair across the board. I thought about this. I didn't really think of a time where an employer showed favoritism, but I thought about youth sports. And when our kids grew up with youth football, and the town that our kids were growing up in at the time, the youth football was all run by parents, usually fathers. Now, just so you know, I don't know a thing about football. My wife knows much more about football than I do. And so our kids were participating in football, but the kids who played and who started and who did all the key positions were the children of the fathers who were the coaches. And since I wasn't a coach, my kid was on the sideline, warming the bench. And they'd come home and they'd be angry. They'd say, "Dad, when it comes to practice, I do so much better than all those guys who are starting. But they play favorites and it makes me mad. Just their kid gets to play." And I remember talking to Cindy and said, "You know, I don't know a thing about football, honey. Maybe I should send you in. You'd probably be one of a really good coach because you know so much about it." We thought about it. I didn't do it. Didn't send my wife in to get coaching and playing time for my kids. But I do remember this, how much it stuck with us and how much it stuck with my kids, that sometimes bosses just aren't fair no matter what you do. And Christian bosses aren't to be known for that. They're to be known for their fairness and not for their partiality. So when it comes to this whole idea of what it means to be an employee, what it means to be an employer, and to honor Jesus Christ in those positions, what we want to remember is, number one, that as an employee, we serve our boss like we are serving Jesus himself. And that even if our boss doesn't treat us right or doesn't reward us right, ultimately when we stand before Jesus Christ, he will reward us based on how we have served and what we have done. And if we're an employer, how do we treat our employees? With gentleness and respect. Do we have motivational conversations? Yes, but we love them. We don't threaten them. We don't berate them. We treat them like Jesus treats us, with that same kind of love and respect. I'm going to pray, and I'll just give you to God. Dear Jesus, I thank you so much for this challenge from your word, this challenge to be good employees and to be good employers, and for us to make your name famous, to adorn the name of Jesus Christ based on how we work and how we treat others in the work environment. I ask that you'd give us wisdom as we seek to apply this to our worlds. And we thank you for the chance to honor you in our everyday life. We ask this all in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.
This has been a presentation of Crosswinds Church. More of Pastor Kurt's sermons can be found online at crosswinds.tv. Thanks for being with us, and may God continue to enrich your life.